Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls. We have with us on the line Mr. John Perkins, who formerly, of course, had worked for a major corporation. Of course, he was really recruited into the whole movement, what he calls the corporatocracy, through the National Security Agency, the super secret intelligence organization that helps to coordinate the corporatocracy. And of course, he's got the most amazing book we've put out. I don't know an awful lot of them. It's called Confessions of an Economic Hitman. And Mr. Perkins is one of the few people on the inside of this whole incredible scam who's been willing to, well, risk everything to come forward to tell the American people the truth about our foreign policy and how, while we talk about wanting to help those poor people in Africa and elsewhere, it's really all a scam. Mr. Perkins, thank you so much for being with us again.
Yeah, and I've been on long enough, I think you can call me John.
All right, fine, John. I appreciate so much your being back with us again.
My pleasure.
Well, you know, of course, we see now they're suddenly going to write off all this debt to these third world countries. Isn't that a wonderful, benevolent thing to do?
It is a wonderful, benevolent thing to do if we were doing it without any conditions. And unfortunately, we were doing it in a way that feeds right into the hands of the big corporations.
Can you get into that? Because, you know, everybody thinks we're simply writing off the debt because we're so concerned about the poverty and suffering. But what's the truth of the matter?
Yeah, Dr. Stan, it really, you know, it bothers me because I want to be joyous about writing off debt. I'm all for writing off the debt, getting rid of this, because most of it's illegal debt anyway that we've imposed on these countries, and some of their corrupt leaders have accepted in the past, and the countries shouldn't be beholden to this debt. Unfortunately, this latest round follows between 5 and 10 years for each of these countries, depending on which of the 18 countries you're talking about, having to have gone through a very long process of agreeing to what the World Bank calls conditionalities. And those include things like agreeing to have their utility companies privatized, water and electricity, and agreeing not to subsidize some of the produce that their countries produce, and not to have any trade barriers to protect their own farmers and other industries in their country, while at the same time accepting the fact that we will continue to have subsidies on things like cotton and sugar that they may also try to grow there, and we will have trade barriers. So, unfortunately, this latest round at this point feeds into the hand of the corporatocracy, not really a gift to these countries at all.
And I think this is what most people don't understand. Now, are there going to be any other sort of, of course, we'll have any claim on their natural resources?
Well, that's always in the picture there. And the very act of privatizing means that you're taking over a lot of the natural resources. For example, when you privatize an electric utility company, often that also involves making resources like oil or gas or hydroelectric power, the rivers, available to the owners of those companies, who in this case will be foreign firms, like U.S. firms and perhaps some European firms. So there's always that aspect, depending on what country you're talking about and what resources they have.
And I think that it's really it's such a terrible, terrible tragedy. Of course, a lot of these companies are just so impoverished that they can't make any payments. Anyway, it's a lot easier for our international agencies to write off the debt because it's really already served its purposes, and now they can lend more and do it all over again. We're going to be back in just a moment with John Perkins. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. Our guest today is John Perkins, and his book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman is one of the most important books of, I think, we've discussed in the last decade, because it's written from the point of view of an insider, a man who is part and parcel of this whole, what he refers to as a corporatocracy. And this is a combination of corporations and intelligence and CIA and finance and our major corporations who have used, of course, this concept of debt to enslave the people in third world countries. And although we were talking before we came on the air about, oh, how wonderful it is that we're writing off debt, I think you have to understand how this debt was established. And that was Mr. Perkins' job. He was actually hired by these by the NSA and then, of course, sent to work for a major corporation. Could you explain how this whole scam worked? Because I think it's so important. Nobody is talking about how much of this money that we lent to those countries actually came back to America in the form of payments to our corporations.
Yes, in the case of strictly American debt, let's say debt that was given by USAID, United States Agency for International Development, or our Export-Import Bank, which does a huge amount of the overseas aid that we talk about. In those cases, all that money comes back to U.S. corporations. Well, perhaps a little trickles down to subcontractors in these countries, but the major contracts are awarded to U.S. corporations. In the case of World Bank and IMF and other sister organizations of theirs, a great deal of it comes to U.S. Almost all of it goes to multinationals. Some of those may be European multinationals, but in many cases, the majority are U.S. In very, very rare cases, does any of the money go to the country in question? And when it does, it usually goes to some very wealthy people in those countries who own pipe-laying outfits or the John Deere franchise or things along those lines. They become subcontractors to the international corporations. Well, most of it stays right in our own country.
And I think this is really what nobody else is pointing out, is that basically your job was, of course, to go into the country and to convince them that they need to spend a lot of money on electrification, because you worked for an electric company. And so the whole idea was to that they would invest in the development of the country, but, of course, all the money would go to American corporations to build up the infrastructure. Was that a pretty good estimate of what happened?
Well, that's true, Dr. Stan. The only difference I might have with you on that is that some of the other things besides the electric utilities, that tended to be a big one in the 70s, but we also, you know, had some other good scams going.
Hold that up for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this afternoon is John Perkins. And John really had worked, of course, with a major international corporation. When I read his book, I found the story so incredible that I tracked down the corporation, and certainly it was there. Eventually, of course, it merged into something else. But basically, his job was to go into the countries and come up with an economic plan that really wasn't valid at all. He knew it wasn't valid. He was paid to come up with a plan that would impoverish that country, that would get them to actually invest all this money with American corporations, which we would lend to the countries, and then they would, of course, pay debt. They would have to pay the interest on that money. And this isn't this where so much of the debt for these third world countries that now we're so concerned about, isn't that where so much of that debt came from?
That's absolutely true, Dr. Stan. The argument can be made and is within these countries a very valid argument that the countries do not owe this money. If you were a private banker and one of your listeners or I was your customer and you convinced me to accept a debt that was a loan that was more than I could possibly repay, and one of the conditions of the loan was that I hire you or your brother to do an incredible amount of work for me, that isn't going to really help me at all. That's sort of the analogy here. And then, you know, if that were to happen in our country, I would have recourse. You'd be committing something criminal by doing that, and I'd have recourse against you. That's exactly the way it happens on the international scene. The economic hitmen arrange for a loan from one of these big banks to the president or minister of some country. The people of that country have no say in it whatsoever. The money is used to hire foreign companies, U.S. companies, to build these huge infrastructure projects that don't benefit the poor at all. All the electricity goes to the big industries or the big mansions or the industrial parks, not to the poor people. And yet the poor people, the country itself, is left holding this huge debt which it can't possibly repay. So at some point we go back in and say, look, you can't repay your debts. You guys are in default. So sell us your oil real cheap, or send troops in support of ours to Iraq or someplace. And now, of course, we're saying, oh, well, we'll forgive that debt. But in order to have it forgiven, you've got to agree to these conditionalities, which is just going to enslave you to us even more.
And this is what the American people are not being told. And John was saying that one of the stipulations was that these people say we're going to have to privatize the utilities. Well, whenever you privatize the utility, why, of course, it's for profit. Now, of course, sometimes a private corporation can work more efficiently, but that's not the purpose, really, in those countries. Isn't that eventually going to end up costing the people there more and really making them subservient to these international corporations?
Well, it's absolutely a ripoff. How would we like it if, the Japanese or the Russians or somebody else were suddenly handed all of our water companies in this country, or our electrical companies, or our sewage companies, and handed this on a plate, and it was private companies in those countries? You know, there's no question that civil servants can be corrupt, they can be inefficient, but the fact of the matter is, you can correct that. The civil servant, by definition, is sworn to serve the best interest of the public, the civic, the public. Whereas a corporate executive has to make a commitment. He's sworn to serve the best interest of his stockholders, not the public. And so when you privatize, you're turning a company over to people whose legal responsibility is to take care of their stockholders, not the customers. And then when you turn this over to an outside organization from another country, so the Bolivians turn their water over to a Bechtel, let's say, as they did a few years ago, U.S. company, who's looking out for the Bolivian people?
And I think this is really what's so vitally important. And what you're doing when you have a utility is you're giving a monopoly. And monopolies are abused. That's why people want a monopoly. There is no competition. If they control the water, they control the people.
Yes. They control so much, you know. I was actually in 1990, I was offered the job as president of Bolivia Power Corporation, which was owned by a U.S. corporation at that time. And it was said that the president, I went down to Bolivia and thought about this, took my family down, and I was told that the president of the Bolivia Power Corporation was the second most powerful man in Bolivia, next to the president of the country. But at many times, he was actually the most powerful man, because Bolivia sometimes has these coups where the military overthrows the president if he's not performing properly. At that time, the president of the power company has the power, has the control as to whether to turn off the electricity going to all the army bases or to turn it off going to the National Guard and the presidential palace. And by doing that, he can really determine what's going to happen to the politics of Bolivia.
Weren't you tempted to take the job?
Well, you know what? I ultimately, and I'll be talking about this in my next book, I was interested, and I went to the owners of the company here in the United States and said, I would be interested in taking this job, but only if you commit to me that we're going to run this company in a way that'll serve as a model for the rest of Latin America as a socially and environmentally responsible entity. And the response that I got was that, you know, we're in the business of making money, not being socially and environmentally model makers.
And, of course, the real tragedy is that the people, as you point out in your book, when we came up with all of these wonderful programs to help the people, they're 50% were impoverished. And how many were impoverished by the time we got done? The figures you probably know far better than I, but I remember things, instead of getting better when we were doing all this help, things got worse for the people.
Oh, there's no question. In the last 30 years, the gap between rich and poor in the world has more than doubled. The gap between rich and poor, more than doubled. Today, 24,000 people will starve to death or die of hunger and hunger-related diseases. Another 30,000, mostly children, will die of curable diseases because they don't get the medicines, which is really our problem. And we get a couple of billion people in the world living on less than $2 a day, which is the equivalent of what they were living on 30 years ago. There's been no improvement. It's gone exactly the opposite direction.
And of course, though, the prices have gone up, and yet, of course, their wages have not gone up, which means that basically their wages, a price-earning ratio, have gone down there. They're making less. They're poorer then now than they were. And of course, as you pointed out in your book, in many of these countries, they get almost half of the money that that the government was collecting in taxes being used to service the debt for money that had been lent by these international corporations and money that had been funneled back into the United States.
Dr. Stan, I hate to say this, but it's getting worse since I wrote the book. When I wrote the book, you can turn to the chapters on Ecuador, and I state in there that roughly half of the national budget of Ecuador has to go to paying down the debt. Since that time, a deal was struck between the president of Ecuador, who was just overthrown by the people about a month and a half ago because of things like this, but he struck a deal with the World Bank, which actually states that of any new oil being taken out of Ecuador, only 10% of the income will go to Ecuadorians. The other 90% must go to the oil companies or the creditors, like the World Bank, USAID, and us. And 90% has to go out of the country. So Ecuador is called upon to destroy its rainforest and its indigenous people and get only 10% of the value of that oil that's taken out of their country.
Well, of course, this is totally corrupt. And what about Bolivia? Now, my understanding is that in Bolivia, why they were going to, take all the natural gas and the oil out of that country, and didn't they have another revolution here recently? They were really having a terrible time. Nobody even wants to be president there.
No, Bolivia was in the mid-80s, the second country in Latin America to accept all these World Bank conditionalities and IMF conditionalities, and to privatize in a huge way. It privatized all of its major utilities, and including, as I mentioned, the electric utility, which then I was recruited to be the president of. And that continues. It's gotten worse. As you undoubtedly know, a few years ago, the water system in Bolivia was sold off to Bechtel. But there were so many riots, so many problems, that Bechtel got out, and now is suing Bolivia, or last I heard, I think it's still in the courts, is suing Bolivia because it was deprived profits. Bechtel was deprived profits that it should have made because of the deal that it had struck with Bolivia, but was forced to get out of because of the demonstrations and strikes in Bolivia.
And of course, the demonstrations or strikes were because of the corruption between the government and the sweetheart deals between the government and Bechtel. Would that be a fair statement?
Well, absolutely. The people don't want their water system owned by foreign companies or their electric system. These are very proud people. Bolivia has an extremely large indigenous population, Aymara and Quechua people, who are very, very proud people. These are the descendants of the Incas and very, very proud people. The last thing they want is to be subjugated again as they were under the Spanish conquistadores, but that's exactly what's been happening to them. And they stood up and said no. And so today there's a tremendous turmoil in that country. It still remains to be seen exactly, what's going to happen.
Well, I think the great tragedy is, John, that the average American really doesn't understand. In fact, the average American says, well, we must be pretty good guys. We're going to write off $40 billion in debt. Isn't that generous of us? In fact, everybody's complaining that money's going to come out of the American taxpayers' pocket, but there really isn't. This is all sort of the fiat money system that they've created. It's all paper entries, but we've enslaved the people, we've enslaved the governments with that debt, because, of course, if they don't pay their debt, then they can't borrow any more money, and, of course, they need that money of course, to pay off the corrupt politicians.
That's right.
Well, of course, the whole world is in turmoil. And what's the attitude of these people towards America? I mean, the average American, I among them, are proud of my country, but our leaders are doing such terrible, terrible things. Well, how do the people throughout the world really feel about America?
Well, this is the really sad thing. Not only have we enslaved these other people and done them damage, but we've done ourselves tremendous damage. After all, the average American is not benefiting from these policies.
And I think that's really what's so important. But the corporatocracy, of course, goes on. And when we get back, we're going to tell you some of the incredible, incredible stories that Mr. Perkins has in his book. It's called Confessions of an Economic Hitman. I recommend it to you. We've sold a couple of cases, and we think it's a very important book.
Have you ever wondered about the boys we left behind in Vietnam, in Korea? Did you ever know that we left 25,000 American boys behind in Russia, in Siberia, at the end of the Second World War? Have you ever wondered what really happened at Oklahoma City, what really happened with TWA 800 that went down off the eastern coast about a year ago? Well, ladies and gentlemen, all of the subjects are well covered in a fascinating book by Craig Roberts entitled The Medusa File. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, order The Medusa File. Actually, Craig Roberts was a police officer working on the Oklahoma City bombing. Now, this book has been suppressed very effectively across America. It's self-published, but I promise you that there's no other book I know that will give you more contemporary history, frightening history that every American needs to know. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR now.
This is health journalist Bill Sardi. In November of 1991, the 60 Minutes television show first reported on the French paradox, the fact the French violate every dietary rule for good health, eat a diet rich in fats and calories, and yet exhibit far better cardiovascular health than North Americans. Over a decade later, we know that molecules called polyphenols are responsible for the health benefits in red wine, but those molecules only remain stable in a sealed bottle of red wine. Longevinix is the first dietary supplement to stabilize red wine molecules in a sealed capsule, just like a corked bottle of red wine, providing red wine polyphenols without the calories, alcohol, and sulfite preservatives. One Longevinix capsule is equivalent in polyphenols to drinking 5 glasses of red wine. Call 866-405-4000 today to order Longevinix. It's a revolutionary dietary supplement. 866-405-4000.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Thierry. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious-tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763. 9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
Hi. Have you purchased or invested in gold and silver coins or bullion in the last several years? If so, you've most likely been taken advantage of. In a lot of cases, out and out lied to. There are several tricks of the trade in play in the precious metals and collector coin markets. This is especially true during a hot market. Although it doesn't take a savvy investor to avoid the pitfalls of unscrupulous coin and metals dealers, it does take some common sense and the knowledge of which questions to ask. The asset management professionals at Colonial Resources can arm you with a few simple questions to ask your current broker or coin dealer. To find out if you've been taken advantage of, or if you're thinking of investing, call Colonial Resources toll-free, 1-800-685-4042. The precious metals and collector coin markets are hot and definitely where the smart money is heading. But before you make a mistake that could cost you hundreds or even thousands of dollars, call the professionals at Colonial Resources. The call and the advice are free. 1-800-685-4042. That's
800-685-4042. This is Dr. Stanback here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is John Perkins. His book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, if you haven't read it, you really need to. Mr. Perkins, of course, when he initially tried to get this book published, you had a lot of trouble getting it published, didn't you?
Everybody turned me down, Dr. Stan. 21 publishers, including all the major ones, wouldn't touch it, and my agent got back an amazing letter. This book is riveting. It's a great story. It needs to be told. But every one of them has an excuse why they shouldn't tell it. And I tell in the prologue how I was called taken to dinner in New York by a publisher, president of a major publishing house, and he said, I love your book, but, you know, I can't afford to publish it. I might lose my job if I did. And then a very brave, independent publisher from San Francisco, Barrett and Kohler, did publish it. It went to the top of the charts almost immediately, and suddenly it was being published in all these other countries by Random House and many of the other companies that initially had turned it down in English, and they all fought over each other to get the paperback rights, which Penguin finally got, and will bring it out in paperback in January. But it was a very interesting thing to watch, you know, how they were so scared of it until it started making a lot of money for the publisher, and then they all wanted a piece of it.
And, of course, I've seen it featured in a number of bookstores across America, and it really, of course, I think it's a great, great book, and I certainly recommend it to people. Now, Chris, why don't you give a little of the background of how, when you were first recruited into this movement, you were told that once you went in, you were in for life and you could never get out. Would you like to tell that story?
Well, sure, I'd be happy to, Dr. Stan. I was recruited by the National Security Agency, initially nation's largest and probably most secretive spy organization, and then sent to work for a private consulting firm, which is the way this type of thing is done these days, so as not to directly implicate the government. And then I was mentored or trained by a remarkable woman named Claudine, who's described in some detail in Confessions.
Yes, I could read between the lines there.
I won't go into that here right now, but when the NSA had recruited me, they'd run me through a series of personality tests, polygraph tests, and, you know, identified a lot of weaknesses that I had and a lot of other character traits. And Claudine knew about all of these, and she used them to her full advantage. You know, she told me I'd be getting into a very dirty business and gave me all the warnings and then proceeded to drop on all my weaknesses and basically enticed me into it. I mean, I have to take full responsibility for it, but she certainly knew what she was doing.
And, of course, the thing is that you were into this, and you were in it for a number of years, and eventually, of course, you got out, and then, of course, you wanted to expose it, but a time and again, why they would come up with an enticement or a threat or a bribe, anything to keep you quiet.
That's absolutely true. In fact, I got an incredible bribe. Legally speaking, it wasn't a bribe. I was offered a consulting job, about $500,000, and so that's a legal thing for a big company to offer. I had the prerequisites, you know, I was qualified. So legally speaking, it wasn't a bribe, but they knew exactly what they were doing and made it very clear to me that I wasn't going to have to do much work for them, but I better damn well not write a book about the subject either.
And, of course, one way or another, they can silence people by giving them fabulous salaries, and especially when people are financially in a situation where, and I've seen this time and time again, people are, you know, they've got kids in college that are dependent upon their salary, but you were pretty well off financially. You were in a position where you could actually do pretty well what you wanted, weren't you?
Well, not exactly. I was not poor, but I had a young daughter. She's now 23, and we're talking now the early 90s in this case. And, you know, I was looking at putting her through school and college, and I certainly wasn't feeling plush at the time. I had lived a very good life. For me, when I was an economic hitman, it wasn't so much the pay as flying first class, staying in the best hotels, eating in the finest restaurants, being surrounded by beautiful women. And those things all came my way. And actually, I got out when I was made shortly after I was made partner in the firm and knew I was going to become a millionaire very shortly if I stayed in. That's when I got out because I knew that if I stayed in any longer, I would truly be trapped in the system. I would never get out.
And, of course, really, you knew it was wrong. You knew, but, I mean, it's such an enticement to be there. And, of course, you could almost maybe convince yourself you're helping. But down deep in your heart, you realize what you were doing was really enslaving the people by getting the countries to take on debt. Would that be a fair statement?
That's a fair statement. I also knew that when I didn't work, the jackals, CIA-sanctioned assassins, would step in. And I always feared about that, too, especially when my daughter was young, that it could be physical harm done to me or my family if I didn't go along, because I've seen it happen to others.
And we're going to be back in just a moment. We'll talk a little bit about the jackals and about the fact that the people we're dealing with will not hesitate to resort to violence or terrible, terrible things to people who reveal what's really taking place.
Have you ever wondered what the Vietnamese War was really all about? Why America, the most powerful nation in the world, spent 10 years fighting in Southeast Asia against a nation the size of the state of Mississippi, and America lost that war? Do you really believe that happened by accident? There's so much to the story of Vietnam that the American people have never really known. And in our four-tape set, Vietnam, The Untold Story, you're going to get the information that you need to understand the tragedy of that event. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and ask for Vietnam, The Untold Story, the story of what really happened in Vietnam that has been suppressed from the American people for the last 20 years.
Hi, this is Joyce Riley, and most of you now know why so many people agree that Miracle 2 soap really is a miracle. Miracle 2 products are now being used by farmers and ranchers to increase their yield. Mechanics and machinists use it in their shops. Chiropractors and physicians are using Miracle 2, and the uses are simply too numerous to mention. Dr. Stan and the folks at Radio Liberty knew right away that the listeners would benefit tremendously by using Miracle 2 products. You can enjoy the benefits of Miracle 2 and help Radio Liberty continue to broadcast Dr. Stan's message by calling 800-544-8927 to order your Miracle 2 today. After you've tried Miracle 2 around the house, you'll probably do just what so many others have done. Get rid of all those toxic cleaners and chemicals under your sink. Call Radio Liberty and order your Miracle 2 today. 800-544-8927. 800-544-8927. Dr. Stan Monteith and so many listeners know that Miracle 2 soap isn't just soap. It's a miracle.
Leading edge dentists know the profound effect dental materials and procedures have on the health of the entire body. If you've been searching for a holistic trained dentist who can safely treat you, look no further. Dr. David Biles has been a leader in the Santa Cruz dental community for nearly 20 years. He built a solid reputation providing exceptionally high quality cosmetic and restorative dental care long before learning the very real hazards of common dental practices. Now, as a faculty member of the Institute of Natural Dentistry, Dr. Biles has begun lecturing nationally to other dentists on alternative and complementary dental care. On request, Dr. Biles will safely remove toxic dental materials from your mouth while substituting them with safe, non-allergenic restorations. Call Dr. Biles today and take the next step to improve your health. With sedation and nitrous oxide available, Dr. Biles can help even the most anxious patients. Call 423-0121 and schedule a visit now. That's 423-0121.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, I guess, this afternoon. Mr. John Perkins and his book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which we think is a very, very important book. And Mr. Perkins was talking about, before we went to the break, the jackals. And, of course, these would be, of course, the CIA people who would come in and play hardball with international leaders, government leaders, who didn't want to go along with the program. Would you like to sort of develop that idea? Because I think it's so important for our listeners to know, not what we hear and read in the newspapers, what the real world is like, and what happens to the leaders who fight the system, who try to do what's right for their people.
Yes, Dr. Stan, I you know, it's probably best if I talk about a specific example that I was very familiar with, or maybe a couple of them, because I was sent to Panama in the 80s, in the mid to late 70s, to start with, to bring Omar Torrijos around. And Torrijos, the president of Panama at the time, was a very well-known leader around the world because he was demanding that the Panama Canal be turned back over to Panamanians and was negotiating with Carter on these issues. And so the whole world was watching Torrijos. I was sent down to try to convince them that he needed to come along with our country on many issues, not just the canal issue, but other ones. And he refused. He said, you know, to me, you know, I want to help my poor people. I'm not interested myself in getting rich. I want to help my poor people. The same thing was happening in Ecuador with Jaime Roldos, who was the first democratically elected president of Ecuador after years of puppet dictators, U.S. puppet dictators. And Roldos had run on a campaign to be very nationalistic, as he said, keep Ecuador's resources for Ecuadorians. He won by a landslide and immediately began implementing these. We economic hitmen tried to get through to Jaime Roldos also. We failed in both cases, and in both cases we, you know, as we were expecting. the Jackals came in, and in 1981, both men died, were assassinated by CIA Jackals. They died in fiery airplane crashes 3 months apart from each other. Their airplanes blown up by explosives.
And, Chris, this is a story we see over and over again. In fact, if you are a world leader and you're not going along with the CIA, and you get an offer that you can't refuse, and you refuse it, you better not get in an airplane or a helicopter, because, of course, we know that they killed people. We had the church committee hearings about how they killed one of the fellows over Patrice Lumumba, how they killed certainly people in the Dominican Republic, how they killed Mr. Nguyen and Mr. Diem over in Vietnam. And of course, these are just a few of the instances. Ladies and gentlemen, men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. And when we have a government that operates outside of the realms of civilization, that will kill other leaders who don't go along with our programs, no man's life or property are safe, really, in this country. Have you had any pressure put on you because of the book you've actually written?
Well, I have, Dr. Stan, but I just wanted to comment on what you said a minute ago. Something very few Americans realize is that in 1963, we hired a jackal, an assassin, to take out a very popular president of Iraq, a guy named Qasim. And the assassin we hired was a high school senior. He shot at the president, missed him, nicked him in the shoulder. That assassin was Saddam Hussein.
And, of course, that's well known, and we've read this many places. Isn't it amazing that the average American doesn't understand that we started training Saddam very early?
Well, when he missed this president of Iraq, we then, the CIA, went in and overthrew him in a coup and had him publicly executed on television, and then put Saddam's cousin in charge of the country, and Saddam was head of security under his cousin, eventually replaced his cousin, and of course we sent Saddam billions and billions of dollars and all kinds of, we built him chemical plants that produced mustard gas that killed Kurds and Iranians and others. There's an instance that doesn't come up a lot in this Iraqi war thing, but there's a man we definitely put into power.
And in fact, it was so interesting that they just recently released the videos of the Saddam's preliminary part of his trial, but there's no sound on it. So all you see is Saddam, but for some reason or other, I guess they just don't have the technology over there to put any sound on there, or could it be that they don't want us to hear what Saddam is saying?
Well, certainly that's it. You know, we've seen others who've gone on trial and spoken their mind, and we didn't like to hear what they said. But I think in all of this, Dr. Stan, we need to be aware that we're at a time of tremendous opportunity now, because I think Americans are becoming more aware, and it's why I wrote the book, that when we realize what we're really doing internationally, we'll demand change, and we'll get it, just as we have in other arenas. When we understood, that we were polluting the world with DDT and other chemicals, we began to demand changes, and we got them to a very large degree. We had rivers burning in the Midwest not so long ago, 30 years ago. That's no longer happening. We were spraying our fields with DDT. That's no longer happening. We have plenty of other environmental issues that we need to address. But when we understand serious problems, we do demand change, and when we demand the change, we get it. And so I'm actually very, very optimistic. That's why I wrote the book. I knew I was sticking my head in the noose. I wouldn't have done that, Dr. Stan, if I didn't have a great hope that we can change things, that we can make it a better world for my 23-year-old daughter and her brothers and sisters around this planet.
And your grandchildren, huh?
Yes.
I know you've been on book tours around the country, or you were in our community, and the book, really, how many copies are out? Do you have any idea how many sold?
Well, I just... You know, today, it was still only in hardback, and just today I got notification that they just sent out their 180,000 hardback edition in this country. It's also under contract in 17 other languages and in many other countries, more than 17 in those other languages, and I think all of those are coming out this year, and I think about 6 or 7 of them are already out, and it was a bestseller in Germany. It's doing very, very well in Brazil and Portugal, and I can't keep track of it. So I'm sure at this point there's at least a quarter million, it's probably 500,000 copies circulating, and the paperback hasn't come out yet.
And so, I think when the paper comes out and the price comes down, well, even more people will buy it.
Well, it's very encouraging to me. I'm happy personally in a way, to get that my book's doing so well, but much more important to me is that the American people and people around the world are interested in learning what's really, really going on. And I make a very strong point in the book that we must take responsibility and get out there and demand change.
And I think you do a very good point of that. Now, you talk a little bit about, of course, what we did with Saudi Arabia and how we really brought them really sort of under our control. And the offers that were made to Saddam Hussein, and the fact that if Saddam had gone along with the agenda, he'd probably still be there. Would you like to sort of develop that idea of making the desert bloom?
Well, yes, we have. You know, we did it in Iran with the Shah to begin with, and then, of course, we lost that one. He was overthrown. But then we went into Saudi Arabia in 73 when we had this terrible problem here with oil being shut down by OPEC, cars lined up at the gas stations. And so the Treasury Department came to me and some other economic hitmen and said, look, you got to do something about this. So we went to Saudi Arabia, which had more oil than anyone else, and we make a long story short, we convinced the House of Saud, the royal family, to send most of the money that it made selling oil to the world back to the United States and invest it in U.S. government securities. The interest on that, which is now amounted to trillions of dollars, was given to the U.S. Treasury Department to hire U.S. corporations to build Saudi Arabia in our image, essentially, to build desalinization plants, power plants, highways, ports, in fact, whole cities out of the desert, along with the McDonald's and the Burger Kings and all that kind of stuff. And the House of Saud guaranteed to keep the price of oil within limits acceptable to us, and we guaranteed to keep the House of Saud in power. It's a pretty nifty deal. We economic hitmen counted it as one of our best successes. And we tried then, after it was successful in Saudi Arabia, to introduce it in Iraq with Saddam Hussein. And, of course, as I said, we'd already given him trillions of dollars, lent him trillions of dollars, given him fighter planes and chemical plants and tanks. But he didn't come along with the economic hitmen. And so we sent in the jackals, but they couldn't take him out. His security forces were too good, and he had too many look-alike doubles that even his own security men didn't know who they were guarding. So it's hard to take somebody out if you don't know who you're really taking out. It can be a pretty dangerous game to play, you know. So in 1991... we sent in the military, and we took out his military, but we did not want to overthrow him. He was a powerful leader. We liked that. He was a strong man, and he had controlled. He could keep control sort of on his border with Iran, and so we wanted to keep him in power. But we thought when we took out his military that he now would have learned a lesson and that he would come around. So in the 90s, we went back in, but again, he wouldn't come around. The jackals couldn't take him out. If he had come around either of those times in the 80s or the 90s, he'd still be president. And we'd be building him all the chemical plants he wants, as we had before, and selling him all the weapons he wants. But he didn't come around, so we finally had to go back in and, you know, take him out.
I think this really is such a different approach that I've never heard before. But Saddam Hussein just wouldn't play the game. He really didn't understand the rules. And, of course, the rules are we win, you win, or we win, you lose. But we are not going to lose at all. And so in the process, of course, we've decimated and done terrible things, not only to Iraq and the infrastructure. And here, you know, almost 4 years after, or 3 years after our attack, there's still no electricity. Electricity is intermittent, and water is intermittent, and the water is polluted, and the people in Iraq are far worse off than they were before the Americans came in to liberate them.
And we're a lot worse off, too.
Oh, I know we are.
You know, our country's going bankrupt. We have to go through terrible security systems. In a way, you could say that the terrorists have accomplished their goal. They don't need to bomb any more of our buildings over here. They've already cost us a fortune, disrupted our lives, and put us in a war that we can't get out of. And in the process, we've managed to create a huge worldwide terrorist movement.
Yes, I mean, there are far more terrorists and far more people hate America now than ever hated us. In fact, we had tremendous goodwill right after the 9/11 attack, and I think people even justified our going into Afghanistan. But the Arabs are smart enough to realize we did not go into Iraq because we really thought that Saddam Hussein was about ready to attack New York, and yet that was the theme over and over again. We can't wait. He's got those weapons of mass destruction, and he'll either attack the United States or he'll turn them over to Osama bin Laden so he can attack the United States. We have to attack right away.
I was in Latin America on September 11th, and I've been back several times since. And, you know, right then, after September 11th, as you said, Dr. Stan, the world was on our side. The Latin Americans were very, very sympathetic with us. And they were hoping, though, that, you know, this would sort of wake us up. And we'd say, geez, you know, why do so many people hate us in the world? Let's change something, because, in fact, we have all the resources we need to make this a much better world, to stop those 24,000 people who starve to death every day from starving to death. We can teach them how to produce food to keep them alive. We can also teach them how not to keep their populations growing so that things will get better. We are in that position, and I think after 9/11, the whole world took a deep breath and said, my gosh, the United States now is going to learn. And they're going to use this tremendous amount of resources they have to bring compassion to the world and to really make this world a better place. And I think, you know, we've really disappointed them. But I'm very encouraged. You know, we could say we haven't done that. But on the other hand, 9/11 was only in 2001. This is 2005. That's a blink in the history of the world. It seems like a long time, you know, when you're in the middle of it. But I think we're learning our lesson. I think the fact that we're talking about this on your show, and you have so many shows that talk about similar subjects, and there's so many people on radio and in the press that are talking about, not the mainstream press, but you know, shows like yours, Pacifica, Air America. There's a whole lot of radio stations and a whole lot of magazines and newspapers that are bringing this stuff out, and people really want to hear it.
Well, I agree with it. We've got one caller here. Let's go ahead and take Jim from, I don't know whether he's coming from Montana or what, but here we are. Hi, Jim. Where are you from?
Missouri.
Missouri. Okay, fine. You have a question for our guest.
Yeah, I spoke with you once before on Dr. Stan's show, Mr. Perkins.
Hi.
Two questions. The first, why do you think Saddam didn't play ball? Because it seems like he would have done well if he had, or even better, I should say. And the second is, did you ever feel like you could be in jeopardy if you stayed in your profession simply because you saw all these presidents of countries falling out of the sky around you, and did you think that might happen to you way or another?
All right.
And I'll just listen to you off the air.
Thank you very much, Jim. Let's first go to the first question then. Why didn't Saddam play ball? You know, he would have been far better off if he had just gone along. We didn't care that he was a ruthless tyrant. We'd have been backing him when he was a ruthless tyrant. He'd been on the CIA payroll going back to the time he was in high school. So why didn't he go along?
I don't know Saddam's psychology. I don't know that anybody could fathom that. I think there's two possibilities here. One is that he was very, very arrogant. We know he's arrogant. And he had been there, you know, he had been hired by the CIA. He thought he knew the system. He may have thought that he could just get around it. He would be the exception. That he was in such a critical position with the location of his country and the amount of oil that he controlled that we would have to go along with him. That's a possibility. The other possibility is he's just plain crazy. I don't know his psychology. But, you know, I mean, if he hadn't been so arrogant or crazy or whatever he was, he would have stayed in control. There's no question about it.
And, of course, the second question is, were you ever concerned when you were an economic hitman and you saw the violence was being used against others that you might fall victim to that as well?
Well, I was never concerned as long as I stayed in that I would fall victim because, you know, as long as you're playing along with the system, why would you? I was doing a really good job for everybody. The concern was when I decided to get out. And as I talked in the book, there was this amazing Colombian woman who befriended me, and I was working in Colombia. And, you know, she said, well, you know, you can get out, just don't talk about it. You don't write a book about it. Don't talk about it. What are they going to care if you just kind of mildly get out and say you really support the system, you're really happy, you're just tired, you got to get out. And actually I got out, you know, I said, well, I think what I'd like to do is continue doing this kind of stuff, traveling around, you know, maybe writing articles for National Geographic or something like that, but nothing that would shake up the system. And so but I was concerned that when I got out, I'd be in trouble. But again, she convinced me, and she was right, that as long as I didn't rock the boat and stayed supportive of the system, and in fact, I continued to work as a consultant for some of these companies, as I said, taking bribes from them, essentially, illegal bribes, and I ran an alternative power company that was very much tied in with the system, too. So I sort of stayed in the system, even though I officially got out.
Well, I'm glad now you're such a big target. Why it would be very difficult. If you're going to be a target, you want to be a big target. Because really, I think that is certainly your greatest.
You want to have a book that's out there that if they kill you, millions more copies are going to be sold, and they know that.
All right, fine. Well, look, I want to thank you so very much. We have Mike on the line. Mike, you hang on. We'll just take your comment when we get off after the break. But thank you so very much for being with us, John. It's always a pleasure, and I always learn a certain amount when we have you with us.
My pleasure indeed. Keep doing your good work, Dr. Sand. It's great talking to you always.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, our guest has been John Perkins. His book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and of course, we think it's a great and very important book. And we'll take our call from Mike as soon as we get back. Sophisticated investors are buying gold and silver today because the dollar has lost almost 50% of its value in relationship to the euro, and the price of gold and silver has increased almost 40%. If you're interested in learning more about precious metal investing, why don't you call Bo at 831-423-0177. That's 831-423-0177, or visit him at Elliott's Stamp and Coin Shop in downtown Santa Cruz at 141 South River Street in the San Lorenzo office building, which is located between Trader Joe's and the Signature Twin Movie Theater. Bo's telephone number is 831-423-0177. That's 831-423-0177. And he's located at 141 South River Street in the San Lorenzo office building. And if you mention you heard about Elliott's Stamp and Coin Shop on Radio Liberty, why, you'll get a 15% discount on some non-investment items.
Are you concerned about your child's future? Well, it starts with a sound education. VHM provides for that cornerstone of your child's future with a quality education founded on biblical principles. Our school sets high academic goals while developing moral standards. From preschool through eighth grade, your child is taught by experienced and credentialed teachers in all subjects, including our dynamic music program and state-of-the-art computer classes. Proverbs 22:6 says, "Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it." For over 50 years, VHM Christian School has provided peace of mind to parents knowing their children are receiving an excellent education in a loving environment. VHM is located at 427 Capitola Road Extension in Santa Cruz. Won't you call us today at 475-4762? That's VHM Christian School at 475-4762. Doesn't your child deserve a chance to try VHM? If you're looking for a comfortable residential care facility for yourself or a loved one, consider Cozy Home in Moss Landing. The 6-bed facility provides nutritious home-cooked meals, special diets.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and let's go ahead and take Mike. Hi, Mike. Did you have a question or comment?
Well, I would ask if your guest knew of Presidential Executive Order 12803, the George Bush executive order signed April 30th, 1992. It's titled Infrastructure Privatization. They might as well call it Infrastructure Fascism. It puts everything up for sale to the highest bidder or at the discretion of the Office of Management and Budget.
And one of the things they're planning here is massive new toll roads all across America, connecting Mexico to Canada, and of course they're simply going to take the property by eminent domain, and it's an amazing, amazing program. But
and those highways we privately own.
Right.
I hear the music.
Right, you do.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course, this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you will give very serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do. And quite frankly, we need your help to maintain what we have, and we're almost 60 stations every week. You know, a lot of them are just half an hour on Saturday, but people are hearing the news and the truth they're not getting elsewhere. So if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters for a suggested gift of at least $20 a month or more, you'll get our 4 best tapes of the month, you'll get our monthly newsletter, but more than that, you'll be helping us as we reach out across America. And then we have the book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. We have a four-tape set. It's called Economic Hitman, and it's actually three interviews that I did with John Perkins, and we then have 2 half-hour talks that I gave based upon what I learned from John Perkins. And when you hear them talking about, oh my goodness, we're going to forgive all the debt, remember, the money's already come back to America and to our major corporations here, because most of this money was given with a proviso that would be invested in infrastructure development done by American corporations. In fact, a lot of the money never left the United States. The only thing that left there were the bills we sent them for the interest that was used to impoverish the people. And all you need to do is look and see what's happening to the people of the rest of the world. They're getting poorer and poorer. And the poverty level, the death level, all of this is increasing, the malnutrition. It is because there really are evil people in the world who believe in population reduction, who believe, you know, that the best thing we could do would be to kill off large parts of the world's population. If you doubt that, you need to get our 4-tape set on population control. You need to get our video on population control. And if you get anything ordered from it, you can ask for the Population Control Agenda monograph. We'll send it to you, and you can actually, of course, read what key people have said about the importance of killing off large parts of the world population. If you'd like that article from the UNESCO Courier, November of 1991, where Jacques Cousteau talks about the necessity of eliminating 350,000 people a day, call us at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And ask for a free copy of the UNESCO Courier article or anything else we talk about here that you want us to document. And, of course, actually one of our newsletters is on the subject of today, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and we'll be glad to get you a free copy of that newsletter if you call us, or if you want to order the book or the 4-tape set or both, and we can send you along a copy of that, but we'll send you a free copy of the newsletter. We want you to get this information. We want you to help us get it out across America. Are there evil and wicked people in the world who would like to kill off a large part of the world population? Well, you need to get our 4-tape set, The New Order of the Barbarian. It's an interview with a man who attended a lecture given by Dr. Richard Dame, who was the medical director of Planned Parenthood back in 1969. It is indeed the most incredible 4-tape set we have, and we have actually a transcript of that. We have very few other transcripts, but we do have a transcript of that. If you doubt that they're doing that in America, you need to get my DVD, and of course it's called The History and Toxicity of Water Fluoridation, and you can get a syllabus with that that has a lot of the original documents, including Dr. MacArthur's testimony before the House Appropriations Committee in 1969, just 3 months after Dr. Richard Day talked to a group of doctors up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and said, of course, we're going to have to kill off a large part of the population. We're going to create new diseases. Well, you can read what Dr. MacArthur testified before the House Appropriations Committee about how he wanted $10 million to create a new disease, because they could create new diseases. Back in 1969, this was a new disease where there'd be no immune response. Some people thought that we shouldn't do it because it was another method of mass killing. But he wanted the money to do it. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for Radio Liberty.